Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
It should not be an option in the United States of America for any insurance company to deny women coverage for their exercise of their right of choice. And I am the only candidate here who has passed a law protecting a woman's right of reproductive health and health insurance. And I'm the only candidate who has passed a public option.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. I'll start with that.
That's an interchange between Washington Governor Jay Inslee and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar at the first Democratic presidential debate. Going back and forth, abortion was mentioned several times in the course of that debate. It was, I think, I can fairly say, universally approved of by all of the candidates who were on the dais. We'll see how the second part of that debate goes this evening. And then there is this truly remarkable op-ed piece in the New York Times, and the title alone should tell you something, but it deserves a little fact-checking. The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade by John Irving. We're going to respond to both of those things here in the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Joining us to do so, Scott Klusendorf. He's president of Life Training Institute. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott, welcome back.
Todd, always good to be with you.
So from what you saw of the Democratic presidential debate, the first one last night, what was your impression on the subject of the unborn?
Well, there's no doubt the Democratic Party is committed to the proposition that an entire class of human beings can be set aside to be killed. Now, before any listeners think I'm overstating my position here, I want to quote from the head of the DNC. Okay, this is Tom Perez. He presides over this party. And here's what he said. The right to abortion is absolute. Every Democrat, like every American, should support a woman's right to make her own choices about her body and health. That's not negotiable, end quote. This is a party committed to the proposition that it's okay to intentionally kill innocent human beings in the womb, and let's not fool ourselves about what that party stands for.
So do you expect anything different as the presidential field thins out? I mean, it sounds like everybody is on the same page. They're all singing from the same hymn book.
I do not believe in the term pro-life Democrat as appeals to leadership in that party. They don't exist. And that party is committed to get rid of any pro-life Democrats. And they were making that clear last night in the debate. They were making it clear they were going to try to outrun each other on who was the most radical in their abortion stance. And you saw that on full display last night.
So we turn to this op-ed piece from the New York Times that is provocatively titled The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade. There's enough in that title alone to occupy ourselves with for the next few minutes. What about it?
Well, I'll tell you, the title alone tells you it's going to be a fallaciously argued piece because the title alone commits the genetic fallacy. That's where you fault an idea based on its origins rather than its merits. This article is trying to say to us, listen, if you look at the history of these people, which, by the way, the author gets so wrong as to be laughable, but let's just take it at face value. You cannot dismiss an idea the way this author tries to do based on its origin. You've got to look at the actual pro-life argument and show where it goes wrong. You've either got to demonstrate that the conclusion does not follow logically from the premises of the pro-life argument or that the premises themselves are unsound. This author does none of that. He doesn't even attempt to engage the pro-life argument. That pro-life argument, Todd, is simply this. Premise one, it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion does that. Therefore, abortion is wrong. The author makes no attempt to engage that at all. And instead, what Mr. Irving does is simply engage in the genetic fallacy, trying to fault an idea based on its origins rather than its substance.
What do you make of this? And the author does put quite a point on it several times. This insistence on the term anti-abortion, which I personally have no problem with, but how is that wielded in the by the pen of this op-ed author?
Well, what he's trying to do is win a little PR move here by saying, look, you people who oppose abortion, you're not pro-life, because if you were pro-life, you'd be wanting to take care of all children. You'd want to solve all social ills, but you don't. You only care about restricting abortion. Therefore, you're anti-abortion, you're not pro-life. I'm one who believes we should fight for the term pro-life. Look, nobody says to the abortion choice crowd, you're not pro-choice because you're not for all choices. You're not for school choice. You're not for tax cut choice. You're only for abortion choice. Nobody attacks them that way. But pro-lifers are told, oh, you're not pro-life because you don't take on all these other so-called life issues. You only deal with abortion. But look, when this debate started back in the early 70s in earnest, the two sides were clearly defined as pro-choice and pro-life. Those were their chosen terms, and that's what the labels applied to. And I see no reason why pro-lifers should give up their ground here and say, well, we're not taking on all life, so maybe our critics are right. We'll just call ourselves anti-abortion. There's nothing wrong with being anti-abortion. Opposing the intentional killing of an innocent human being is a good thing to do. So I'm not bothered by the term anti-abortion, but I think we should fight for our terms pro-life, as we always have.
Here is a little bit from near the end of the op-ed piece in the New York Times. You got to start someplace. I'm going to start here in the middle. Quote, the prevailing impetus to oppose abortion is to punish the woman who doesn't want the child. What would you do with that, Scott?
Well, let's get something clear right away. Number one, there has never been a pro-life law anywhere that punished mothers for having abortions. And there were sound legal reasons for constructing them that way. The first was that you needed the woman's testimony against the doctor. Secondly, you needed to prove, in order to show co-conspiracy, you had to show that the woman's knowledge of the act of abortion matched that of the doctor performing the abortion. That's nearly impossible to prove in a court of law. So what legislators would do is they would do like we do with drug laws. We go after the supplier rather than the user. And in this case, it was always assumed we'd do better at limiting the evil of abortion if there were stricter penalties for the doctor than there was for the mother. Now, should there be consequences for intentionally killing an innocent human being? Of course. But as to what those consequences would be hinged on whether there was a meeting of the minds, meaning the mother's knowledge of the act matched that of the doctor. And that's very difficult to prove in law. And that's why lawmakers said, hey, listen, we're going to construct these laws to punish doctors more than mothers.
The op-ed piece also refers to the sacralizing of the fetus as a ploy. What is he asserting there?
Well, here we go, another genetic fallacy where we judge the alleged motivation of somebody rather than the actual merits of their argument. How about this? The real division between me and Mr. Irving is not that he loves women and I hate them. The real division between he and I is this. I think the unborn are members of the human family. He doesn't. Would he argue that if we were trying to protect 2-year-olds from abuse, or we were trying to protect 14-year-old girls from sex trafficking, that we were guilty of simply trying to hate those that are engaged in that and impose our religious views on them? No, he would never argue that way. He only argues that way on abortion because he assumes without argument that the unborn are not human beings, and that's the point he needs to engage that he never does in this piece.
What else stood out to you in the op-ed piece?
Well, his bad history, for one. Let's be clear about what happened in this country. Here's a guy who's writing a piece that's trying to tell us about this dark history of our movement, and he doesn't even get the history right. Abortion was never a mainstream practice in 19th century America. In fact, historians from Dr. Joseph Della Pena to Marvin Olasky have made the point that in 19th century America, abortion was primarily practiced by women who were seduced out of wedlock, who were engaged in prostitution, or involved in spiritism. In other words, this was a small percentage of women who fell through the cracks of society. And most women who conceived out of wedlock, the historical records show, by the time they gave birth, had been married because society would put pressure on young men to do the right thing, unlike today. So this idea that abortion in the 19th century was being practiced by women who were desperate, and it was a widespread practice, not so. It simply isn't the case. We can also point out that the purpose of these laws was not to protect women from unsafe surgical procedures, the way that Justice Blackmun in Roe v. Wade argued. Rather, as medical science made clear that the unborn were human beings, laws against abortion became more and more common. In fact, at the very point we see the knowledge emerging about fetal life in the womb, the scientific knowledge that life begins at conception, namely in the late part of the 19th century, we see laws against abortion at that very time becoming more and more common and more restrictive. The purpose of these laws was to protect unborn children, not protect women from unsafe surgical procedures.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest. We're talking about an op-ed piece in the New York Times titled "The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade." When we come back, we'll deal with some more of the fallacies and simple, what do they call it now? Fake news, fake facts in the op-ed. In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Pastor Paul McCain joins us to talk about daily prayers and the table of duties.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
I paid for the murder before they determine the sex. Choosing our life over your life meant your death. And you never got a chance to even open your eyes. Sometimes I wonder as a fetus, if you fought for your life, would you have been a little genius in love with...
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're responding to an op-ed in the New York Times titled "The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade." Scott Klusendorf is our guest, president of Life Training Institute. The heart of the op-ed, Scott, really is a paragraph that I'd like you to deal with point for point. And I'm going to read the entire thing. "I respect your personal reasons not to have an abortion. No one is forcing you to have one. I respect your choice. I'm pro-choice, often called pro-abortion by the anti-abortion crusaders, although no one is pro-abortion. What's unequal about the argument is the choice. The difference between pro-life and pro-choice is the choice. Pro-life opponents have no qualms about forcing women to go through childbirth. They give women no choice." Deal with that point by point, if you would, Scott.
Well, first of all, imagine if I were to say to you, Todd, that, listen, I'm not going to force you to beat your wife, but if you want that choice, you should be allowed to have it. and we should not interfere with you. And how dare someone come along and say you've got to be pro-marriage by respecting your wife rather than beating her? That would be an outrage, and yet that's the moral logic that's in play here. And what he's really getting at, what he's trying to appeal to here, I believe, is the personally opposed crowd. And that makes up a large segment of the American population. The population that says, well, I personally oppose abortion, but I don't think I should impose my views on others. Well, let's give that a little test drive. I personally oppose slavery, but if you want to own a slave, I'm not going to impose my views on you. Or I personally oppose spousal abuse, but I'm not going to say what you do with your own spouse. Anybody who argued this way in today's culture, we would immediately recognize that their moral compass was broken. And yet when it comes to abortion, people will argue with that very same logic. And let me tell you why, Todd. They have assumed the unborn are not human. They haven't argued for it. They just assume it. They assume the unborn is not one of us the way that wives are one of us, the way that older children belong to the human family. They simply assume the unborn aren't human, and the pro-life community cannot let them get away with that. We have to call that assumption out and say, wait a minute, you could be right that the unborn aren't human, but you're going to have to argue for it. We're not going to let you just assume it.
What about this notion that pro-life proponents want to force women to go through childbirth?
Well, I got news for you. Do we complain about women being forced to go through motherhood by raising toddlers? Do we force them? Do we complain that they're being forced to go through the rocky teenage years by continuing to raise teenagers? Again, we're assuming the unborn aren't human. By the way, pro-lifers didn't force this woman to become a mother. What engaged that behavior was her sexual activity. So it's just wrong-headed from the beginning.
Then what do we do with, you know, an op-ed piece like this that is obviously fraught with errors? And to my way of thinking, after reading it, the water has been so muddied, the point has been lost. How do we, other than doing what we're doing right now, having this conversation, how do we cogently respond to something that so very much mucks around with the facts and muddies the waters?
Well, notice that this piece nowhere describes the act of abortion, does not do anything to ask the question, well, what is abortion? Instead, it just attacks the motives and the history of those involved in the fight to stop abortion. So I think the first thing we need to do as pro-lifers is focus this debate on the question, what is abortion? And the answer to that question is something we can engage in objectively. There's not a woman's perspective on abortion any more than there's a man's perspective on it. It's arguments that need to be advanced, arguments that need to be evaluated, and we as pro-lifers should define the game rules here. We're not going to let people co-opt the issue by attacking the history of how we got to where we're at. The second thing we need to do is make abortion concrete, and this is why showing visual depictions of abortion, like we did at the Issues Etc. conference a year ago, where as part of a larger pro-life apologetics presentation, we included the imagery so that people knew exactly what we were talking about. And one of the ways we break through the muddying of waters that you referenced a moment ago, Todd, is we show people abortion to change how they feel about it as a predicate to changing how they ultimately think and behave about it. So when people see abortion, it tends to reawaken their moral sensibilities. They stop thinking about it as a personal preference issue, like choosing chocolate over vanilla ice cream, and they start to think in more concrete terms. But that's very hard to do if we don't first change how they feel about it, and the images do that. Then what we do is bring in the facts and arguments that change how people perceive this issue, and we correct the bad history. For example, in this piece, where Irving says, we don't know why doctors lobbied to outlaw abortion. Yes, we do. They told us flat out why they did, because they believed it was the taking of innocent human life. And then Irving says, well, these docs just wanted to control women's lives. Funny, the feminists at the time didn't think that. In fact, the feminists of the time agreed with the doctors who were working to outlaw abortion, and the feminists argued, even those like Victoria Woodall, argued that abortion was used by men to manipulate women so men could get free sex without consequence. And they called abortion the wanton destruction of innocent human life. So if this was men just wanting to control women's lives, the feminists of that day didn't view it that way.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute and author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. You can purchase this book and learn more about Life Training Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Scott, thank you very much.
Todd, always good to be with you.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., our series on the Lutheran Confessions continues. We are walking through Luther's Small Catechism, very gradually getting to the end of the, well, we've been through the six chief parts. We're going to go into what some have called the seventh chief part after a little visit in the daily prayers and the rituals that Luther talks about for rising, going to sleep, and mealtime. The Table of Duties will be the main subject of our conversation with Pastor Paul McCain next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.